From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, police work in Michigan versus policing in Britain. Quite a contrast.
There will be officers that will go their entire careers, and we do 30 years in the UK, they will go their entire careers and never have an incident involving a gun. They might not even see a gun.
A nonprofit teams up with a theater group to make community connections.
What's so exciting about Kickshaw is not just about sitting there and being entertained. It's about really exploring the issue.
And the High School Ethics Bowl.
High school is a really great age to begin engaging students with ethical theories and encouraging them to kind of take a step back from the world around them and think ethically about it.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Kickshaw Theater is bringing a new way of producing plays. Partner with a nonprofit and then present a play that really connects with the community.
They can grab hold of and say to their friends, "This is me up on the stage. I can't put my story into words, but here it is right here."
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, community engagement through theater. But first, if you're a police officer in the United Kingdom, you probably don't carry a gun. In fact, you could go through your entire career and never fire a weapon. A pretty stark contrast to police on this side of the Atlantic. Michael Matthews is a police constable with the London Metropolitan Police. He's now attached to Scotland Yard, and he's just spent time shadowing Detroit police officers. It's all research for a book that he's writing about the DPD. And his time with Detroit cops was an eye-opener for him. Michael Matthews is with us now. And, Michael, I know you're at an airport in transit back to England as we speak.
I am. I'm just standing around snowy Toronto at the moment.
Well, I'm glad we could get you on Stateside. Michael, tell us a little about your police career in England, just so we kind of get a sense of what you've been doing in police work.
Sure. I joined the police in London in 1994. My father was a policeman before me. And I started off in North London in a place called Kentish Town, which was a busy inner city area. And from there, I went to Heathrow Airport, where I carried a gun for a few years, 3 or 4 years. And then from there, I went to Scotland Yard working in intelligence.
And you've already written one book called We Are the Cops, The Real Lives of America's Police, after you visited a number of American police departments. I'm wondering, Michael, what got you so interested in the way American police officers do their jobs?
Growing up in the UK, you get so much media and television and obviously movies, and a lot of that is American. So you see these American cop shows, you see the American movies, and you know, as a young kid growing up in the UK, seeing like, you know, watching Kojak and these sorts of shows and Hill Street Blues, it's a completely different world. And I didn't go to the US for the first time until I was about 20 years old. So this is a whole other world. And the police in the US are so different to how they are in the UK, or they certainly look that different when you watch it on television. You know, it's all excitement and action, and there's guns and these car chases and language like perps. And you just don't get that in the UK. In the UK, it always seems a lot more mundane. You know, policing can still be exciting in the UK, can still be dangerous. But certainly in comparison to the TV shows I grew up watching, it's in a completely different world. I was always fascinated with American policing, and America for that matter. You know, I'm very interested in the country itself. So I always wanted to come and visit the US. In fact, before I joined the Metropolitan Police in London, I actually telephoned the embassy, the American embassy in London, asking how I could become a cop in New York.
Huh.
And when they asked me if I was American, I said, no, I'm English. They sort of laughed and put down the phone, and that's my American police career finished with there and then. I've always wanted to come, and I did eventually. About 12, 13 years ago, I came to the US for the first time to spend time in the police. In that time, I've traveled all over the country. And as you said, my book, We Are the Cops, is a result of my travels around the US, you know, from Alaska to Mississippi, LA to New York. And I went to Detroit for the first time about 12 years ago. And of all the places in America I went, it was Detroit that stood out the most.
Why was that?
Detroit just seemed that bit more extreme. I call it extreme policing in Detroit. You know, policing can be exciting and dangerous all over the country, but Detroit, the environment that these cops work in, the danger they work in, you know, just the feel and the look of certain parts of Detroit. Everyone talks about the ruins and stuff, and certainly, you know, that you do see that. And downtown changing, of course, massively in Detroit, but outside that, you know, these dangerous neighborhoods still exist. It just seemed that bit more exciting, that bit more dangerous, and that bit more extreme.
Hmm. So you came back to Detroit to shadow Detroit officers. What kinds of things did you do?
On this last trip, I spent time with a gang intelligence unit, which are a great bunch of officers doing, you know, really excellent work. And I've been embedded with them for the past couple of weeks. And in that time, you know, they show me the gang areas in the 9th precinct, especially in the 5th precinct in the northeast. And in that time, you know, I've witnessed them make a gun arrest. We're actually driving past a gang house, a known gang house. The sergeant on the unit wanted to specifically show me this house. And as we were driving past, a guy came out and was just staring at us. And as we looked at him, we saw that in his hand, he's holding a handgun. So we drove around to do some observations on him. He went back into the house. And as we were standing there, he came back out and came towards us with his hand down his waistband. And we realized he was still holding the gun and he's actually looking like he's going to come to attack us. So the cops ended up jumping out of the car with their guns drawn and they did arrest him. And he did have a handgun down his trousers. So I saw that. I've been out on some surveillance operations with them. We raided a house. There's a known dope house. So all sorts of exciting stuff and very, very eye-opening stuff. But not just those exciting cop moments. But I also got introduced to a guy called Ray, who's working in the school in East English Village. And Ray sat me down with some gang members who attended the school, and he works with them, bringing these kids together, trying to get them onto the right path. And Ray's an ex-gang member himself. He grew up in Detroit and was a gang member, but now he's completely changed his life, and now he works with these kids, getting them off the gangs. And it is very revealing and very interesting to sit and speak to these boys who were all enemies once in different gangs, and now coming together, and they're friends. And it just shows that, you know, you can get away from these gangs, and the work that Ray is doing with the police, with the DPD and the school, you know, it has a great effect.
I'm talking with Michael Matthews, who's a police constable with the London Metropolitan Police. He's currently attached to Scotland Yard, and he is researching a book he will be writing about the Detroit Police Department. You talked about that vivid impression you got growing up watching TV, Michael, watching shows like Kojak and Hill Street Blues, and they're like, how did the reality of day-to-day police work in Detroit and the other departments that you have observed in America, how did that compare to what you grew up watching?
Yeah, funny you ask that. It's actually quite similar in many ways. Even little things like seeing the guys with the guns on their hip, that straight away just, you know, has flashbacks to these cop shows and the way they speak, the cars, the streets, even the street signs, you know, all this stuff makes you think you're in a television show. And the actual work they do, yeah, there's more bureaucracy, there's more paperwork, but it can be, not always, but it can be just as exciting as those television shows I grew up watching. A good example of that is just the other day, as I said, I was out with the cops, and here comes this guy out of a house holding a gun, looking like he's going to shoot us. I mean, this isn't a daily occurrence in the UK, certainly not where I worked.
Because that's what I wondered. We know that there are tough, tough neighborhoods in London, and you're saying that would probably not happen in those tough neighborhoods? What would they do, come out with a knife, perhaps?
Yeah, knife crime is certainly more prevalent in the UK than gun crime. The reason for that is, you know, our gun control is extremely strict. There are guns on the streets of London and the UK, of course there are, and there are shootings, but certainly not to the level you see over here. I mean, in 21 years' service, I've had one incident where a guy's come at me with a gun. There will be officers that will go their entire careers, and we do 30 years in the UK, they will go their entire careers and never have an incident involving a gun. They might not even see a gun. At the start of this interview, you mentioned about how officers will go their career and never fire a gun. Actually, officers can go for their career and never even see a gun in the UK. They're that rare. They are out there. It does happen. But they're certainly not as prevalent as they are in the US.
I know. I actually, in getting ready to talk with you, I checked with my nephew, who is a London police constable, who's at Heathrow. And I said, do you carry a gun? And he said, no, no weapons, no firearms for me. He's with the SATs, the Safer Airport Team. I don't believe he's ever carried a gun in his career with the London police. And that stuns Americans, doesn't it, when you tell people that?
You know, it's completely normal in the UK not to carry a gun, of course. We have 130,000, approximately, police officers in the whole of the country. And out of those 130,000, only 6,000 are currently trained in firearms. Not all of them are carried, that's just who's trained. That number's starting to go up. They want to increase those numbers because of the threat of terrorism and such. But at the moment, yeah, just 6,000 carry. And when I tell police officers in this country that, no, we don't really carry guns in the UK, I don't currently carry a gun in the UK, they are always shocked and surprised and express, you know, how they couldn't imagine doing their job here without a gun.
You touched on that fear of terrorism, and I know that is something that my nephew at Heathrow knows is an issue. They're out there as a deterrent for possible terrorist attacks. Do you see that moving UK police in the direction of having to be more armed?
Well, it is. I mean, it's been in the national press just in the past couple of weeks, actually, about the numbers increasing. I think in London, they want another 600 police officers trained in firearms. So it is increasing, but the day-to-day policing, the normal uniform patrols, will still be unpoliced.
Hmm. And what kind of public response is there? What reaction to that talk of increasing the numbers? Is it accepted? Is it resisted?
It's hard to say. I mean, there's always going to be those that are for the arming of the police and those that are against, I suppose. I mean, I can't speak on behalf of the police, but in my experience, I've never really noticed an appetite from the public for the police to be armed generally. And even within the police, they've asked the question before, do we want to be armed? And most police officers have said no. They've had votes on it. We don't want to be armed. Some police officers said they would leave the force if they were armed. You know, most people don't want guns, and because we just don't have a gun culture in the UK. And that's no criticism of the US. You know, it's just two different cultures. And it's not our culture. As I say, most people will never even see a gun in their entire life in the UK. So I think there's not a lot of appetite from the public or the police. But saying that, I should imagine there will be an understanding with the current threat levels being what they are, that why we are asking to increase the numbers.
So give us an understanding. If I see a police constable walking along, you know, Hammersmith on patrol, what is he or she carrying for protection?
The general police officer on patrol will be carrying an ass baton, which is one of those extendable metal batons, and a can of pepper spray and handcuffs, and that'll be it.
It is pretty stunning. It'll be fascinating to get your take with that background, bringing to what you've observed with the Detroit officers you wrote with. When do you hope? What's your deadline for getting your book out?
Next year. That's the hope. It's certainly going to be an interesting book, I think.
Well, we will look forward to speaking with you when it does come out.
Wonderful. I'd love to speak to you again.
Michael Matthews is with Scotland Yard. He is a veteran police constable with the London Metropolitan Police. He'll be writing a book about the Detroit Police Department, and as he told us, looking to have it out next year. Michael, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are many, many ways high school students can compete. Certainly sports like football, basketball, swimming, track, and cross country come quickly to mind. We're going to talk now, though, about a different kind of competition, the kind that demands brain power as opposed to muscle power. It's the Michigan High School Ethics Bowl. This competition is hosted every year by A2 Ethics in partnership with the University of Michigan Philosophy Outreach Program. We've got with us today Janine DeLay, who's president of A2 Ethics. Good to have you with us, Janine.
Thank you very much for inviting us, Cindy.
And Zoe Johnson-King is with the U of M Philosophy Outreach Program. Hello, Zoe.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So let's start at the very beginning. Janine, what is an ethics bowl?
So an ethics bowl is a judge tournament where student teams come together in front of a panel of three judges and then another team, and they discuss applied ethics case studies and are scored on their presentation and on their commentary and their discussion. So it is a judge tournament that includes a philosophical discussion and conversation. And unlike debate, Ethics Bowl really prizes, or the premium is on a congenial or companionable kind of dialogue, right, rather than confrontational or aggressive tactics.
You know, the goal is to figure out what's true, rather than to beat the other team down with the power of your argument, you know.
Figure out what's true, which means there has to be a lot of time thinking about and exploring and digging into whatever case they're working on.
Exactly, yeah. Students spend a lot of time just thinking through the issues, really taking it apart, picking apart a case. Sometimes they go and do additional research to find out more information if there's certain features that they don't know that they think might turn out to be important. And they spend a lot of time also with us, the graduate students in the Michigan Philosophy Department, studying ethical theory, learning principles, concepts that they can apply to the cases to try to get clearer about, you know, what they think should happen.
Now, when we say cases, Zoe, what are we talking about?
Ah, okay. So a case is maybe half a page to a page of writing about some particular moral or political issue. Often it's a dilemma. There's a difficult choice a person has to make, and the question is, what choice should they make? Sometimes it's more a description of a state of affairs, and the question is this morally permissible? Is it okay? Should it be changed? What should we do about some problem? And cases range from the very, very abstract to the very, very concrete, and from the very global to the very local. So let's think of some examples.
Yeah, give us an example.
So there would be a wide array of fields. There would be bioethics or medical ethics, mm-hmm. Education ethics,
or
topics.
Okay, so pretend I'm a team and you're giving me a case.
So,
just give me an idea.
So one of the cases this year is called Selecting for Deafness. And this is a case where two deaf parents mm-hmm. want to have a child, and at the same time, they want to select an embryo for a particular trait, and that is deafness. And so this poses some profound ethical mm-hmm. questions and dilemmas. And so Zoe is coaching at least two of the teams right. about ways to approach this using ethics concepts and theories, in addition to talking with them about their own views.
Zoe, how is it that you teach ethics to teenagers when it seems that they can turn on the TV and see reality shows that contain so many messages and behavior that really are anything but ethical?
Oh, well, you know, I find that high school is a really great age to begin engaging students with ethical theories and encouraging them to kind of take a step back from the world around them and think ethically about it. And that's because I find that at high school age, students are already starting to take that step back themselves. As you mentioned, there are a lot of influences on them from a lot of different directions. Students are already beginning to think about the kind of person they want to be, about which of those influences they want to allow to have a formative effect on their personality. They're thinking about what their priorities are, what careers they want to go into, what hobbies they want to take on. And they're kind of already starting to think ethically about which principles they want to use to guide their life. And I find that, of course, you know, we know the names for the principles, we know the names for the theories, we're familiar with the, you know, kinds of objections, kinds of applications, because these things have been studied and written about before. But very often, if you raise an issue or a case with a group of students, they effectively come up with the principles, with the objections, with the theories themselves, and you just have to tell them, oh yeah, there's a name for that. I think that this kind of thinking is really deep in the human psyche. I think there's a really important need that many of us have to take a step back from our situation and approach it in a principled way.
Well, let's hear now from some of these high school students. We caught up with Basil Bakush, who's a student at Ann Arbor Pioneer High School, and he talks about how he and his teammates prepare for the competition.
With each case, it comes a lot of research behind it. We're really looking at both philosophical trains of thought, like the actual philosophy behind each of the, our approaches to these cases, and as well as, you know, the actual, like, real-life data that goes into this, you know, statistics and, you know, number crunching and stuff that goes into these ethical decisions that we have to take into account. It's really a lot of, you know, looking beyond the case itself, going online, reading these books, reading the ethical, you know, readings, and trying to understand that so we can approach this a little bit more informed.
This year, there's been one particular ethics case that Basil's team all agree was the most challenging for them. Here's No Beryl, Grace Stefan, and Lizzie Williams describing case number 6.
We kind of all disagreed really heavily on case 6, and so every time someone says, hey, let's talk about case 6, everyone groans a little bit. But basically what case 6 is, it's about this 75-year-old man who's receiving hospice care for cancer, for lung cancer. And he's been saying racial slurs to the people who are providing care for him. And so it's kind of, what should the supervisor for the hospice care do? Should he send different aides? Should he cut off aid completely? Or should he just tell his aides to put up with it? And we disagree really heavily on that. And it's a really tricky situation to kind of handle, because I don't know, it's difficult to talk about without offending anyone.
I think it's definitely the most controversial case that we've come across. I mean, I've been talking to it, just, you know, people that I know, and they're like, oh yeah, that's hard. That's how sort of everyone reacts, and then we have to like actually figure out what we want to do with it. And it's a lot about like long-term, you know, consequences versus short-term. And you know,
it was just a really interesting case because it's one of those things that happen in everyday life that a lot of people don't think about, that we have to think about as high school students, not as hospice providers.
taken on some pretty complex philosophical issues. We've been talking about this year's Michigan High School Ethics Bowl, which starts in the fall. It's an extracurricular activity, so you're building up to Bowl Day this coming Sunday. What's at stake? Sunday's competition.
Okay, so the winner is the Michigan State champion and receives the Hemlock Cup, which is like the Stanley Cup that goes from school to school. So the current owner of it is Ann Arbor Pioneer. And then they go on to the National High School Ethics Bowl, which is at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill
Run by the Paul Center for Ethics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I have to think, now you've done this 3 years. Zoe, here you are in the philosophy program.
Right.
Are you seeing an uptick in high schoolers saying, you know what, maybe I want to do philosophy?
You know, it's funny you should ask that because, in fact, we recently welcomed into the Michigan Philosophy Department two of the members of last year's winning team, both of whom kind of changed their plans over the course of last year, one of whom was already planning to go to U of M, and she plays the flute and was going to major in music, and now she's also minoring in philosophy. Another of whom was not thinking about attending UM and changed his plans and is at Michigan taking philosophy classes. They got the bug big time, so here they are.
I would also think as a parent, if I had a youngster that wanted maybe harboring dreams of law school,
exactly,
policy,
it's a very similar
political
style of
science,
argument.
All mm-hmm. of those things, what a good way to begin that process of being a critical thinker.
Absolutely, yeah. The skills are very transferable. The ability to really think clearly about a really contentious, complicated issue and to analyze arguments, see how they relate to one another, weigh different considerations, that's a really important set of skills to have for a really broad range of fields.
Well, again, the Michigan High School Ethics Bowl, and it all came up. All that preparation will be happening and paying off at Bowl Day this Sunday, and you can get information on that and also perhaps how to get your high school involved by going to A2, that's the number 2, A2Ethics.org. And we've been talking with Janine DeLay with A2 Ethics and Zoe Johnson-King with the University of Michigan Department of Philosophy Outreach Program, making converts along the way. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Celebrities have been throwing their money into the Flint water bucket, making appearances recently in the city. Let's meet one celeb who has a personal connection to Flint's water crisis. John Connor was born and raised in Flint. He was living in Flint up until 2 years ago, and that's until Dr. Dre got word of his music and signed him to his record label Aftermath. Connor then moved to California, but his heart remains in his hometown.
Honestly, you know, I am Flint. That's been my whole, you know, career is, you know, anytime you see me, it's Flint, 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 Flint. Like, that's all I've ever been about. So I didn't want to be the dude like that in a time where my city needs me the most. I'm somewhere in Cali with an umbrella in my pina colada. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, man, that's crazy. What's going on in Flint? You know what I'm saying? It's like, no. I'm going to go home and I'm going to go be with the people.
Connor's been in Flint for the past 2 weeks. He's volunteered at the Food Bank of Eastern Michigan and the Boys and Girls Club in Flint. And he dropped a song while he was in town. It's called Fresh Water for Flint.
More kids go to jail than in colleges. They act like they don't see where the problem is. This shit, we resilient. Reality is every day we was living like hostages.
Michigan Radio's Emily Fox met up with John Connor at his mother's house in Flint.
But as you can see, like, you already got your bottle of water is right there.
The water at this house is in better shape than other houses in Flint. John Connor's mom has been tested for lead, and she's fine. Connor is running the faucet in his mom's bathroom sink. It's clear today, but it isn't always.
Like, the water situation here is, yeah, you know, before I got here, I asked her that same question, and she said, yeah, my water comes out like a yellowish color sometimes, and when it's not that, it smells like bleach.
Connor says this water crisis wasn't the first disaster that Flint has faced. I asked him how he would describe Flint outside of the water crisis that's happening in the city right now.
you know, my whole career, I've always been trying to bring an awareness to Flint and places like Flint. Like I said the other day, like the water situation wasn't the start of Flint's crisis state. You know what I mean? It's like before this, it wasn't the greatest place to live. You know, before that, you know, you had a crime rate that was steady, having Flint be in the top one and two most dangerous places to live, you know, in the United States. And even, I don't know if you looked around, you know, when you came, you know, today, because we're sitting in my mother's house, it's like, you know, the scenery is not inspiring. You know, you got boarded up houses, you got my mother who lives in between two vacant lots, and then around the corner from whole neighborhood blocks that are abandoned houses. You have, you know, automotive industry that was here and then picked up and left, and that kind of drained the city of its hope. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, before the water situation, Flint had a lot of things that we needed to fix, you know, in the first place, a lot of things we needed to concentrate on. But this is something like I've never seen before. Like, this is like third world country.
Tell me a little bit more about what life was like here in Flint growing up as a kid.
So I grew up on the north side of Flint, where when I was growing up, it was always a predominantly black area. But the thing is, it was like, you know, the houses were kept up, the lawns were cut, you know, you could go outside and all the neighborhood kids, you know, you playing football or stuff like that. It reminds you of like the neighborhood from Friday. The heart of your neighborhood is good. And that's what I feel like, you know, nowadays the heart of Flint is kind of being taken out, you know what I mean? And so, yeah, growing up in Flint, it was cool. But also, I grew up thinking that certain things were normal that weren't, you know. I grew up being used to hearing gunshots at night. That wasn't, like, even I joked the other day, like, there's a gunshot drill that I think everybody in Flint know. If you hear gunshots, you cut all the lights out, you get on the floor for, like, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, cut the TV off, and then it's like, okay, and then you wait for, like, the car to go vroom, and then you know to get back up, and everybody goes back to watching TV. It's like, I didn't know that those things weren't normal until I started moving around and living outside of Flint. Like, wow, it's kind of cool not hearing gunshots. You know what I'm saying? It's just kind of sweet. But I love it because it's the adversity that made me who I am and gave me the strength to become the man that I am. So I wouldn't trade any of it for the world. But, you know, that's why it breaks my heart now.
I mean, we have seen a lot of changes with Flint, especially when a lot of things changed with the auto industry. But with this water crisis right now, how has that changed Flint?
You know, I'm here in my mother's house. I came to from California to check on my moms and check on my loved ones and all of that. And, you know, friends of mine have been coming over, and I'm always a dude. I like to gather people together and just be positive about things. But, you know, I had a friend of mine, you know, she had to go get tested for lead, right? And, you know, these are things that we read about in the paper, but I'm seeing it firsthand how it's affecting the people. Like, she broke down in the middle of us laughing and talking. It was just like she started crying because it's like it's real, like that our kids have to go get checked and could be damaged for the rest of their life. It's like the effect that that's having on people, it really breaks my heart, because what I have always loved about my city is that no matter how hard it was, we like, nah, it ain't that bad. But this thing right here is like something that's so devastating that you can't even pretend because it's so real.
When you're talking to friends or your family now that you're in town, what upsets them the most about the situation?
For one, the fact that it's even happening. You know, think about it. Like, it's a couple things that you cannot live without. And one is air and one is water. And I think that also what bothers people is that there are children who didn't have a choice in the matter. You know what I mean? It's like adults in positions of power made this decision about lives that have barely even got started and barely even have a chance to live life. They don't even know what's going on. I think that the fact that, you know, there was no choice in the matter, the fact that it's even happening, the fact that you trust, you know, your government, you know, to make decisions like this, you know what I'm saying? And now it's like, who do you trust when, like Michael Moore said, it's not a natural disaster. This is a decision that was made to save money, so.
The risk to lives of people here in a city that is majority African American, where 41% live below the official poverty line.
when they knew the truth that this water was poison, they chose to keep it quiet. They knew that the people here did not have the political power to do anything about it.
They want me to talk about these fake crimes and these hate crimes. How the fuck I'm supposed to care about overseas when locally everybody in my city and state done? They want to act like it ain't happening. Or like I'm just rapping. Like I'm gonna watch y'all kill my city and y'all wasn't gonna get a reaction. No, no. Every time I go visit for Christmas, it seems like it's more houses that's missing. It looks like it's more houses that's boarded. Oh, I'm posing, I say this shit, but the fact is poison all in all water. It look like population.
Flint native and rapper John Connor's song Fresh Water for Flint will be part of a full-length album that he'll release this summer. It will be dedicated to the city of Flint. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Wednesday's House Oversight Committee hearing on the Flint water crisis certainly brought the thunder from angry panel members.
This is the United States of America. This isn't supposed to happen here. We're not some third world country where you get 100,000 people who get poisoned for long periods of time.
And the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the EPA pointing fingers of blame at each other. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House is with us now. And Daniel, as you note in today's column in the news, the outrage cuts across party lines, and well, it should.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I think everybody here, Republican and Democrat on that committee, came to the same conclusion, and that is that ultimately the decision here was made by emergency managers who work for the governor of Michigan. And that the DEQ in the state did not require Flint to add corrosion control to the water coming out of the Flint River, period. You didn't see Republicans on this committee jumping to the defense of Governor Snyder of the state of Michigan in any way, shape, or form. You did see them kind of disproportionately criticize the EPA, but even the Democrats were critical of the EPA. I think there's a lot of blame to go around here, but the central actors and the central decisions, I think everybody pretty much knows what happened here.
It's something interesting that you pointed out in your column, and I've seen elsewhere, you saw Representative Justin Amash slamming the emergency manager law. There's been so much discussion about the EM law, and I'm wondering your thoughts. Do you think the criticism should be about the law or the individuals who were Flint's emergency managers through this water disaster, or both?
Well, I think that's you're asking a very good question. In fact, one I was thinking about yesterday as I was writing this column. Is it the law or is it the people that made the decisions? I think ultimately in this case, it's probably more the people that made the decisions who really made bad ones. But nevertheless, we are in an election year. I think you see the politicization of this whole thing was, I think, laid very open yesterday, not only at the committee hearing, but near the end of the day. You had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders announce that they were going to have a DNC-sanctioned debate in Flint 2 days before the Michigan primary on March 6th. I mean, you saw Dan Kildee, who represents Flint, I think, trying to look very gubernatorial and sound very gubernatorial in talking to the committee. You had Candace Miller, a Republican from Southeast Michigan, who's going to be retiring, who puts forth a $1 billion bill for Flint. This is a fairly conservative Republican, not known for being a big spender, but certainly being mentioned as a possible candidate for governor in 2018.
And of these individuals, you know, would say, we want to put politics aside and do what we can to keep the spotlight on Flint and keep the help coming.
It's very difficult to put politics aside in a context like this. And I know that you can overplay the hand and say that this is all about politics, and I don't think it necessarily is. I think the Snyder administration, by the evidence, has clearly acknowledged that they've made a mistake here and that they own it and is moving to fix it and is taking a lot of incoming fire, political incoming fire, even as they're just trying to do their job. But it's clearly becoming a political issue, which, frankly, doesn't help the people of Flint one iota.
Governor Snyder, as we know, has made it such a priority to make this a business-friendly state. So, Daniel, for business leaders who are perhaps considering setting up shop in Michigan and bringing their tax dollars and bringing jobs, what does all of this, the hearing and the coverage of the Flint water debacle, what does that say to them about our state and about our governor and his team?
I don't think it says a lot of the good things, frankly. And I think one of the real concerns that people should have here, just average citizens, is the impact of this Flint water crisis on what was a real improving narrative about Michigan and particularly about Detroit. You know, the Detroit bankruptcy defied a lot of predictions in terms of how it was resolved and how quickly it was resolved. And at the same time, you've had billions, literally billions of private sector investment in the city of Detroit, a lot of it by Dan Gilbert, but not all of it by Dan Gilbert. Now the question becomes to what extent this throws that narrative out the window and gets things off track again. Remember, we live in a very open 24/7 news cycle. These things don't take days and weeks and months to get to would-be investors. They take nanoseconds, and mm-hmm. people will know about this, and they'll say, you know what, we're not going to go there. We're not interested in playing in that game. So I think that's a real problem. And then add on top of it some of the problems we're seeing with Detroit public schools. I think the narrative is much more complicated than it was even a year ago.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
If you miss the show on the radio, it's easy to catch us on iTunes. Just search for Stateside. While you're there, please give us a review. We'd really like to hear what you think.
Creation.
Heart of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
A new theater group in Michigan is bringing a new approach to funding and producing plays. It's called Kickshaw Theater. Its first production, The Electric Baby, is at the Interfaith Center for Spiritual Growth in Ann Arbor right now. Kickshaw's artistic director, Lynn Lammers, is with us now. Welcome.
Hi.
Good to have you here.
So good to see you.
And we welcome Amy Milanovich, who's the executive director of the Kite Network. It's a nonprofit group providing grief support. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you so much.
If you're wondering why a grief support network has teamed up with a new theater company, we are about to find out. But start, Lynn, by telling us just what is Kickshaw Theater and what makes you different from other theater companies in Michigan?
Kickshaw is all about exciting our curiosity. We came upon this idea of curiosity because I was hearing Taylor Mack speak.
Now, who is Taylor Mack?
Taylor Mack is a performance artist, an actor and writer, brilliant artist. And he said, well, what if we asked audiences to come to the theater with their curiosity rather than needing to see their experience up on stage? What if they came expecting to see something that expanded their perspective on the world and gave them a greater sense of what being human is? The other piece of that is the connectivity piece. So we're about creativity, curiosity, and connectivity. Are we making theater just because we like theater? Are we telling stories that really matter to someone in our community that they can grab hold of and say to their friends, their neighbors, their loved ones, this is me up on the stage. I can't put my story into words, but here it is right here, which is why we're doing the extra legwork to get out there and connect the work we're doing to different community organizations. And we were so happy to make friends with the folks at the Kite Network because they get it. They get what we're trying to do.
Amy, tell us more about the Kite Network and then how you came to be involved with Kickshaw.
The Kite Network is a local nonprofit organization, and we provide grief education to the community, but mostly peer-to-peer support to adults who are in grief. So we actually recruit individuals who've lost loved ones and have acclimated to their loss, and we pair them with individuals who have had a more recent loss. And, you know, what people sort of report is that when you are in grief, sometimes you have lots of support around you, sometimes you don't have as much support. But often what makes the most difference to people is talking to others who have had similar experiences. The organization was actually started by local families who had lost a child and found that they did grief support groups and they did therapy, but what they found was really the most meaningful was talking to other families who had lost children.
You've walked in my footsteps.
Exactly. You've walked in my footsteps. And people who have been in that kind of grief also understand that you can't take away the grief. What the Kite Network is about is allowing someone to walk that journey with you, just to be by your side, to be your beacon of hope. You got through it. You're sitting here. You still get up every morning. You still get dressed. You've figured out how to live a different life, but a new life, and I can do that too.
How did the two of you find each other so you could take this message and have it reflected in the production that Kickshaw is doing, The Electric Baby?
To have a really authentic relationship with these community organizations, it takes lots of legwork to get people to trust us and say, hey, we have a product that's going to really speak to you and be interesting to you. So we have one person dedicated to that. Her name is Heidi Bennett. She's our connectivity associate. And she put the word out there. She started connecting to different grief organizations, social workers.
I have to ask you, is that because you had this play, The Electric Baby? And it's about grief, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
So you had the play first and
we
you
had
went,
the play first.
We need to match up.
Yeah. We did a table reading for a bunch of our partners back in November to give them a sense of it. We also sent the script out to lots of folks. We wanted to take the time to let them know what we were about and that we wanted to tell their story. Because if this doesn't matter to anyone in the community, if we're just doing theater for art's sake, you know,
it's way too precious.
It is. It needs to matter to somebody. And so when we sent the script to the Kite Network, we got this reaction. I remember Heidi calling me and saying, this Julie woman from the Kite Network is ecstatic about this story. It spoke to her. It made her cry. She connected to it on that deep level. And it has to come back to the art. It has to be about the art. Is the art doing the community any good? That's why connectivity is so important to us.
And now you have The Electric Baby at the Interfaith Center for Spiritual Growth in Ann Arbor through the 21st of February?
Yes.
What is the play about?
It's about six people whose lives interconnect in these really strange ways. And slowly, as the play evolves, you start to see how they're related and connected to one another and how it all kind of comes together by the end. And they all end up circling around this electric baby, this baby who has a terminal illness and is fighting to survive. And they all end up kind of gathered around this very special baby. Along the way, they're trying to figure themselves out, figure their lives out. And they've all experienced grief and loss in various different ways. It sounds like a sad play, doesn't it? But I tell you what, on opening night, we had so many laughs.
Well, I saw a review from critic Patty Nolan in The Examiner, and here's her words. One of the most imaginative, sweetly melancholy comedies we've seen in a while. And she also describes your cast, in her words, as a dream team of Detroit favorites. Mm-hmm. Now, there you were, Amy, you and people from the Kite Network, interacting with the cast. How did you each affect each other?
In some ways, I think this was always meant to be. As I said, we do community education, and we've gone into hospitals. We train social workers, and we connect with other community partners. But we had been talking about trying to find a different way to help the public explore the issue of grief and potentially doing it through art. So we had talked about visual art. We had talked about music. Mm-hmm. And I got this email from Heidi. It was like a gift that just dropped in our laps. I mean, truly, we felt immediately like this was exactly the kind of thing we were looking for, where we could partner with an art-based organization to figure out how to help people explore grief in another way. I think we just were blown away by a lot of the authenticity in the story. There are parts of it that each have their own realm, just like real life. But I think Julie in particular, who's been through the loss of a child, just felt so deeply moved by a lot of the experiences that the characters in the play feel.
We're talking about the newest production of the first production, actually, of the Kickshaw Theater, The Electric Baby, at the Interfaith Center for Spiritual Growth in Ann Arbor, as we explore this on The Next Idea with Kickshaw's artistic director, Lynn Lammers, and Amy Milanovich, who's executive director of the Kite Network, working together. Another new approach is the funding, is this not?
If the folks that are in the audience are really connected to the play, they'll have a deeper emotional connection to it. The Kite Network is doing this amazing work, and they just needed to find a way to tell their story. They're just as motivated as we are to get people to come and see the show. Marketing the arts is really difficult.
Yes. There are many well-intentioned groups that have foundered on the shoals of how to get the word out and how to get butts in seats.
Absolutely. You know, with TV, you see commercials, film, there are trailers, and you're familiar with the writers, the director, the actors. You know something a little bit about it. To come out to the theater, you don't
know any of those things about the product you're about to see. So really the best way to get somebody to the theater is to have somebody that they know and trust and love recommend it. So if the Kite Network is going to their friends and saying, hey, this is high quality, they're telling a story that has great meaning for me, you got to come, there's no better endorsement.
Amy, tell us about the special performance this coming Saturday night. What's it going to look like and what do you hope will happen from this?
This Saturday night, we have a special Kite Night at Kickshaw. And following the regular show, there'll be a reception and a kind of talk back where representatives from the Kite Network will sit with Lynn and with one or two of the actors and just have a conversation about some of the issues that come up in the play and explore the issues related to grief and loss and how people grieve differently and what that looks like and how it's kind of portrayed and then how it happens in real life. We also have some of our Kite Network peer counselors who will be there at the performance. And, you know, we hope that there'll be engagement from the audience. And really, what's so exciting about Kickshaw, and I think what Lynn has been talking about and what excited us, is it's not just about sitting there and being entertained. It's about really exploring the issue. And this, we hope, will give people an opportunity to further discuss what they've just seen and what their reaction is to it, and to hear a little bit both from the production side as well as the Kite Network side about our reactions to the play and our sort of reflections about how that reflects into real life experience.
You know, Lynn, the next idea is about seeking innovative ways to make Michigan better. So what kind of innovative things do you think you're doing that other theater and arts groups can learn from?
We're really intentional about how we connect to the community. Otherwise, who cares that we exist besides us? We're having great fun making theater, but who cares? That question is important to us. We're also interested in telling diverse stories and looking at stories from diverse perspectives. And one of the reasons why this play works so well is that it looks at grief and different kinds of grief from lots of different vantage points. It opens up a great opportunity for this conversation we're going to have with the Kite Network on Saturday after the show, because we get to talk about all the diverse ways in which people experience grief. This summer, what we're doing that's slightly different that a lot of other professional companies aren't doing is we're doing the Kickshaw Lab, which means we're doing a piece that's going to be a bit more bite-sized. So it's going to be 15, 20 minutes long. It's going to be experiential. So folks are going to be able to walk through the piece and experience it happening around them, kind of like a haunted house, but it won't be scary. It's going to be kind of irreverent and funny and silly and a kind of a fun thing to do on your way to or from dinner, to or from the bar, and something that we're hoping folks in my age demographic might want to come see.
Lots of interesting ideas. You can learn more about the Kite Network at their website, which is thekitenetwork.org, and get information on performances and tickets for The Electric Baby by going to kickshawtheater.org. Lynn Lammers, Artistic Director of Kickshaw, and Amy Milanovich, Executive Director of the Kite Network. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Stateside's director is Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Scon. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Ryan Grimes, Sean McHenry, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.